Good morning, Mother Earth. Thank you for all your abundant gifts. Good morning, Father Sun. Thank you for feeding all living things on Earth. Thank you, Plant Kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, Animal Kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, Great Spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Hello and welcome to Shaman's Keep. This is Caroline Wise King, your host, and it is my pleasure today to welcome a previous guest, Wabun Nguyen. So you may not have heard her show before, so I'm going to give you her introduction, and you'll learn more about her as we go along. She is a journalist and an author and was medicine helper to Sun Bear for almost 25 years. Sun Bear was the Chippewa visionary who formed the Bear Tribe Medicine Society in 1970. Together, they wrote many books about Native American spirituality and conducted medicine wheel ceremonies and gatherings all over the world. They were at the front of the Great Awakening that began to happen in the 70s and 80s. They were some of the people that were the front runners and catalysts in bringing about this tremendous change in people's viewpoint about spirituality and about self-worth and things like that. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you again to the show, Wabun. Thank you for joining us today.
And it's a great pleasure to be here with you again, Caroline.
Well, before, I know you've got a new book coming out in the fall, but before we start talking about your new book, I'd like to talk a little bit about your extraordinary journey in this life that's almost as if you've lived three or four different lifetimes all rolled into one. Would you mind telling us about this, starting with life? I'll call it life one, growing up in a typical middle-class white family. Where did you grow up and how was that life?
I grew up in a one-bedroom apartment in Newark, New Jersey, in a building that has since been torn down. And I had one brother who has passed over. When you say you have a typical middle class, I would say I was working class, not middle class, childhood. My father was a disabled war veteran, and my mother had to go back and get her degree in teaching, and she supported the family. So I got to learn to do a lot of things at a young age, like cooking for the family and things when I was under 10. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time with my mother's mother, who was near Scranton, Pennsylvania. And she was a character, and I say that in the Southern novel sense of the word. And not an easy person to get along with a lot of the time. I think we can say a very repressed, disciplined childhood, which mm-hmm. meant that there were a lot of things I wasn't supposed to do, and the main things I was supposed to do was be good and not talk too much and listen to my elders and what they told me to do. Mm-hmm. I will say that put me in good stead later for listening to Native elders. So okay. It served a purpose. I was a very good student. I was very active in extracurricular things. I was, to be honest, a goody two-shoes. in just about all the ways I could be. I got bored with public education by high school, so I found a lot of extra, actually earlier than that, I would always look for things to do that would get me out of the classroom because there were more interesting things in the world. So I would cook for the teachers at school, and that was in grammar school when they were having parties. I established a school page in the local newspaper, and I was the editor of that. I was on all kinds of writing committees and things. One thing that people seemed to like, the adults around me, was my writing. And so from the time I was 7, I started writing poetry at that point. And I was a voracious reader and writer. And it seemed like that was always what I was supposed to do. I went to the College of Worcester in Ohio for a year.
Okay, but that's getting into life number two. Hold on a second.
Okay,
because your childhood, that was a lifetime in its own right, because you went through a shift when you went to college. But
absolutely.
Yeah. So during, I know you said that you learned from that experience how to cook and how to communicate with elders and how to listen to elders. Was there anything else that you'd say you really learned from that experience of growing up in that kind of family?
Yeah, and I'm going to be honest about some things that I remember when I was 13 that I vowed that I would raise dogs, but I would never have a child until I was sure that I could raise a child in a kinder way than the way I was raised and the way that I saw the kids around me being raised. I know that people say relative, you know, poverty is ennobling, and it can be, but it also can make people be mean because they don't have enough. And I saw a lot of what was outright cruelty to children around me, and I wasn't always treated very well either.
Yes.
People, you know, corporal punishment was the way people disciplined in those days.
Oh, yes, spare the rod and spoil the child. I remember that well.
Right, some of it was very excessive. And I know that still happens today with children. And from my childhood, I think my interest now in talking to people about how to raise children in a more humane way that allows them to become the people they were born to be, came from having a childhood where I had no encouragement to do that.
Yes, I understand that fully. Like you, I came from a dysfunctional sort of family. I've come to believe there's no such thing as a normal family.
No, I agree with you on that.
But from the dysfunctions that we grew up with, we learned a lot of things about life and people.
So, right.
Okay.
And I think one of the worst, to me, the worst old boys network in the world is the one where people say, I was raised that way, so I'm going to raise my kids that way. And they don't question that.
It's like,
and
didn't you learn anything?
And if they don't question, you know, how do you feel now as an adult? Do you want to do that to another human being? I knew I did not. And that, I'll talk about that how that played out in the later stages of my life.
Okay, now, moving on to your college years and your years in journalism. Tell us a little bit about that. That was like life number two for you.
Yes, it was. I went to the College of Worcester in Ohio. I had a full scholarship there for a year. And I didn't feel it was the right place for me being at that point. If this was in the 60s, if they had thought at that point of letting women be ministers, because Worcester is a Presbyterian school, if I had thought there was any chance of that, I probably would have stayed there and gone to seminary. And now there are many, many female ministers. But back then, women were supposed to be ministers' wives. So I did not see that I could get to be what I wanted to be. And there was a minister who helped me get the scholarship there and who had a profound positive effect on my life and helped me, you know, get out of the home situation and into the college one. But I decided since I couldn't do that, I wanted to be more where I could go into politics. I thought maybe I can change how people treat each other through the political view. And I went to D.C. and I got my bachelor's in international communications from George Washington University. And while I was in D.C., I worked for my congressman, who was Peter Rodino at that time. And, you know, he was very, very prominent as head of the Judiciary Committee. I worked as a congressional intern. I worked for the State Department 1 year in college. And I was doing all this while taking a full load in college. Wow. I wanted to join the Foreign Service. And again, I ran into, I took the written test and I was 1 point away from passing it. And I was told, don't bother taking it again because women hardly ever pass the oral exam. So the second thing I wanted to do, I got stopped because I was a woman. And I know women today don't think in these terms because so much seems more open than it was then. But there were a lot of things you couldn't do.
Oh, yes.
Back in the 60s. So I was torn between law school and journalism school. And I decided I didn't want to be in school 3 more years. And I applied to the 3 best journalism schools in the country and got into 2 of them. And got, the one I wanted to go to was Columbia, which probably still is the best journalism school in the country. And I went there for my master's degree, which was a 1 year program. And that was very educational because at that point, Fred Friendly, who was a pioneer in television, was teaching on the faculty there. And they were sending all of the, oh, there was a quota of women at Columbia Journalism at that time. No more than 20% of the class could be women.
Oh.
And so we had a class of 120 were women. And they liked to send us into a lot, into Harlem, into Bedford-Stuyvesant to cover stories there. And it was a very radicalizing year. It was also 1968 at Columbia, which was the year of the big anti-war demonstrations.
Right.
And I was involved with everything political at that point. And kept bumping into the same thing. I would be in a political organization and I would be vice president. And they would say, well, we can't nominate you for president because you're a woman. So I started thinking, this is not different in any real way.
Yeah.
And it was from that that I went into, then I became, I thought, well, if politics, well, I followed politics for a while longer because my first book was called The People's Lawyers, and it was about lawyers from the ACLU left. And I spent a year interviewing them.
Wow.
And then I had to, in those old days, type all the interviews up from tape. And people were using the word struggle 6 times in one sentence. And it just got, I realized that they were struggling, but they weren't accomplishing anything except struggling that I could see. And so I became interested in consciousness. And there were many ways to be interested in consciousness in the 60s. And at various times, I experimented with a great number of those. And from there, I wrote about music. I interviewed the Hells Angels after Altamont. I went to Woodstock. I interviewed the Grateful Dead.
Oh, my.
I wrote stories about animal welfare. I was thinking of this the other day, back in the 1960s. And I was going all over the place. I went to lectures with about Tibetan Buddhism. I practiced yoga, and I was very involved with the Gurdjieffian spiritual group, and none of them seemed to be making the change in me. I was involved in encounter groups, Gestalt therapy, but nothing. It didn't feel like inside of me was changing, or that I was finding an effective way to make change in the society. And that brings us to life three.
Well, you were in New York for about 4 years, weren't you, doing all this journalism work?
Yes, I lived in New York City.
Okay, well, tell me something. What did you learn from that period of your life between college and then working in journalism and all, besides the fact that the door was closed for women? What did you learn about life from all of that?
I learned how necessary internal change was for people and how very difficult it was. I learned that there were a lot of things that you could do to try and change yourself, but I did not feel that any of them were reaching deep enough into the core of my being. And I learned that even in all of these alternative cultures, women seem to be in the same position and children seem to be in the same position. That
And
the
nothing had
change
changed
here.
on the in the world except that people were getting high and dropping LSD and and radically fighting against things. But yes,
Right.
but a woman was still a woman and the door was closed.
And children were still property to be treated as you wanted to treat them.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting.
And
Now,
I learned that a spiritual world existed and that there were many pathways into it, but I had not found the right one for me.
And then you crossed paths with Sunbear. How did that happen? How did that come about?
I was in California researching the book about lawyers, and an old friend of mine from New York, a poet, told me he had heard about a reincarnated Hopi medicine man who was looking for reincarnated Indians to be part of a tribe he was forming. And so I pictured Sun Bear as a bent over 80-year-old man who was doing something interesting. He was founding all these communities and inviting people of all races, of all ethnicities to come together and see what they could form. And so I wrote to the address I was given to contact Sun Bear, said I was a journalist, and I had heard he was traveling cross country and said I'd like to interview him when he came to New York and maybe do a magazine article about him. And they wrote back and said, great, he needs a place to stay in New York. And a number of months later, he shows up at my door. And he wasn't 80, he wasn't Hopi, and he was not a bent over old man. I was,
Actually, it was quite handsome at that time, wasn't he?
yes, he was quite handsome and very, very, very virile, very much a man.
What was he,
And
about 40 then?
yeah, he was 40. I was 26. And there was an immediate spark that I totally misinterpreted. Well, not totally. He saw me and he knew that I was to be part of his vision. I saw him and I thought he was to be the great love of my life. So we came together with different agendas, but we were meant to come together.
Oh, yes, obviously.
And about 6 months after I met him, I moved out west. And that was, believe me, a very radical change. I found myself, instead of being a New York author, you know, a few days after I got out there, I was in a trailer in the middle of winter in Nevada, helping to butcher a cow that had been roadkill. And the rancher had given Sunbear permission to bring the cow in so that the people in the tribe would have meat for the winter.
Wow, what a change.
What a change.
Yes.
And there had been changes in the tribe in the time since I first met with Sunbear in New York. Mm-hmm. He had had a falling out with some of the people who had the communities because they weren't obeying. There weren't a lot of rules of the tribe, but one was you don't mix medicines and you don't put psychedelics with the medicine of the pipe and Native American people.
Oh,
and
right. Yeah.
Some of them did. And so Sunbear had gone back to the Reno area where he had lived before he started the tribe and began to rebuild. And it was, the tribe was just a small group of people when I went out there, having been several hundred people when he was in New York. And my job, as it turned out, was to help him rebuild the tribe in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Without LSD and, and
right.
the psychotropic drugs and all of the 60s. Okay.
Right.
But you worked with him for 25 years, right? As his medicine helper?
It was 16, let's see, 26 until 44. No, 40, about 20 years.
Okay, 20 years. So
well,
right.
20 years living with the community and then an additional 6 years. So, yeah, you're right. 26 years.
So, and how many books did you two write together? I mean, you did a lot of writing with them.
I did. We wrote 6 books together. Let me see if that's correct. No, it's more than that. We did the whole Medicine Wheel series, which is the Medicine Wheel, Dancing with the Wheel, Dreaming with the Wheel. We did his biography, which is a great book, and I highly recommend that people look at that because
the Path of Power is that the name of it?
Path of Power.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Walk in Balance, which is the path to healthy, happy, harmonious living. And then I also wrote a book about crystals called Light Seeds. Mm-hmm. The Bear Tribe Self-Reliance book. I just finished my 11th book, and I think out of those, I did four without Sunbear, so 7 books together.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Okay. So so what did you learn from living with the Bear Tribe all those years? That was such a radical change an apartment in New York City. So now you're on an Indian reservation or with basically mostly, a lot of Native Americans, but there were people from all over the world that joined the Bear Tribe.
Right, it was not a reservation because Sunbear wanted to be on land that could not be taken away. We spent some time in Nevada, and then we moved to Oregon to help the remaining Klamath Indians there. Gosh, this could take hours and hours if I go into too much detail. So.
Okay, just.
And then we moved to Vision Mountain in Washington State, and it was on a mountain where we found petroglyphs, picture writings. It said that it was near Spokane Indian Reservation, that it was a place that the Native people had used for vision questing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things the Bear Tribe did was take people on vision quest. It was such an experiment in building community and such an experiment in seeing how people could change and if people could change. And all too often we would find that people would come there and they would run through the tapes they normally had in life. And when they ran out of the tapes, they were ready to move on to another place, which I find to be true a lot of people in life. It's very, very difficult and frightening to change. You know,
people are afraid of it, yes.
Yeah.
But the ones that are courageous have tremendous rewards when they go through the changes and all. So
yeah.
Would you say that maybe 10% or 20% of the people that experienced the Bear Tribe teachings and all actually changed?
Oh, everybody changed. It's how much they changed and how long the change lasted.
Oh, okay.
I'm
but
talking
everyone
about,
was affected, yeah.
About living in community.
Right.
We always had a community on Vision Mountain. We also had the apprentice program in which people would come and study and then go back to wherever they had come from. And I think that caused really a lot more change than the community, because people would take the change they had learned and they would take it back and it would spread.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea how many people changed because of the Bear Tribe, a tremendous number.
Oh, I'm sure it was huge, because, I mean, his teachings and his charisma and everything, it touched people's hearts and spirits. And there were people all over the world that were affected by this. I mean, it was a whole new perspective in how life could be lived in a harmonious way.
It was. And then we started doing the medicine wheel gatherings, and those were the first of the big New Age gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early ones, we would have 1,000, 1,200 people coming together and learning from Native teachers, not just Native American from this country, but from all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And those had a tremendous effect upon people. They started the careers of a lot of the shamans who are still teaching today.
Mm-hmm.
There are still medicine wheel gatherings happening in Germany as a result of the book and the work that we did. And, you know, the book was translated into, I think, 10 different languages. And in fact, right now I'm working with a woman, it's never been translated into Spanish, and she has done a translation, and we're working on bringing it out in Spanish in Spain.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
So it
okay.
Goes, the book is over 30 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
And the medicine
I know.
Wheel.
And it's still as good as the day that it came out. So, well, out of all those years with Sun Bear and all the Native American teachings and all, what would you say is the biggest lesson you learned from all of that?
Oh, I couldn't just say one, but some of the bigger lessons I learned was how essential it is to realize that humans are a part of the earth, but are not the most important part necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Just
and
one of the spokes in the wheel, right?
Right. And that we have to pay attention to the earth and to all of our relations on the earth and show respect for all of our relations on the earth. We have to learn to listen to each other. We have to give respect to elders. There was a great deal more respect for women in a lot of Native cultures, and that's another, at least our talk, but most Native people came from matriarchal cultures.
Oh, yes.
Which, you know, if you're Celtic heritage, as I am, and I think you are too, that's true of our people too. But not as recently.
Mm-hmm.
And so Native American people remember more of what it was like to be in the matriarchal culture.
Mm-hmm.
And Native people, traditional Native people, would treat children as gifts of life rather than as possessions.
Oh,
and
that's
I
wonderful.
Had clan mothers who told me, you can never spoil a child with too much love. And this is traditional. This isn't necessarily how it is today. Again, too many Native people live in poverty and face the same problems that anyone else living in poverty face.
Well, yes, and they've lost their connections, the heritage and all. So many of them have lost it completely. And so they're trying to live in a culture that they don't really understand and by rules that don't fit right with them, you know. Well, that's beautiful. I'm so glad to hear these things. Now you had all of a sudden another huge shift in your life. Life number four, you met and married a child psychiatrist. Tell us about your husband.
Well, I met Tom when he came to do a vision quest at the Bear Tribe.
Oh.
And I had met him previously when Sun Bear and I were out speaking. And he had been, he has a scientific background and a very spiritual background also. He knows, he's a true Renaissance man. He's good at everything he decides to do, including crafts and art and becoming a physician. He came to the Bear Tribe. He was there for a number of years. And at one point in the progression of the Bear Tribe, I realized that I needed to take some time away from the tribe and see what I needed to do to complete my vision. Mm-hmm. And so I lived apart for a number of months, close by, but apart, and decided that I needed to put more time into my own writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that time that I did the book proposal for Woman of the Dawn, which is the beginning of my story. It's a spiritual odyssey that covers the time from my meeting, the time I lived in New York and meeting Sun Bear in my early days with the Bear Tribe, until the Bear Tribe just began to get to the point where it was known, becoming known in a much wider circle of people.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was living apart, looking at my own vision and how I was fulfilling it, Tom and I decided that we wanted to actually get married and that we wanted to have a child. And he said, you know, you're fulfilling your vision, and my vision has always been to be a physician. And he had the background in his education to do that.
Mm.
And so he took a course to prove that he could still study at the advanced age of 38 and was accepted into medical school at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And we did get married. As I was telling you before we went on air, Sun Bear was one of the medicine people who performed our marriage. We were very married. We had Brant Secunda, who is, I think you've had him on the show.
Yes. Yes, I know Brant.
Brant did a blessing, a Weechol blessing on us. A Cherokee clan mother did a Cherokee joining and blessing on us. And we had a Unitarian minister there just to make everybody's family happy.
Mm-hmm.
And Sender did a pipe blessing on us. And at that point, he had been accepted in medical school in Des Moines, Iowa.
Oh.
And it was time for us, you know, I had known it was time for me to leave the community and let other people do the work that I had been doing. I was still connected with Sun Bear through the writing and, you know, through our friendship, but it was time for me to go into the next stage of my life. And I will say that I think the Bear Tribe did wonderful things in many ways. I did not think that a community could be a communications community and a child-centered community very effectively. And so I had discouraged children from being an active part of the Bear Tribe because I felt if you were not going to focus on raising children well, that you shouldn't be raising children. And I wanted to focus on that if I was going to, in fact, have a child. when I tried to have a child, I found out my biological clock had ticked out.
Oh, no.
And I, in fact, had some problems and had to have a full hysterectomy. I went into the surgery reading Brook Medicine Eagle's article that we had printed in Wildfire magazine, the magazine that the Bear Tribe did, about people being called into the grandmother's lodge early because of the need for grandmothers, and how many people were being called in through surgery, through hysterectomies.
Wow.
And 9 months after I had the hysterectomy, I adopted my daughter, our daughter, Kyla, from Peru.
Oh.
And she
How old was she when you got her?
I was able to have her when she was 2 weeks old.
Oh, how wonderful.
And
so she's always been your baby.
Yes, she has.
Yeah.
And she's the daughter of my heart. Absolutely. And I stayed in Peru for 4 months because once I had temporary custody of her, I was not going to give that up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another story. It was, you know, a great opportunity to learn about Peruvian culture.
Mm.
And then I went, when I left from Iowa, I came back to Pennsylvania. Tom continued his training. He became a child psychiatrist and a therapist. I was involved and still am involved in a type of therapy that has made profound inner changes in me that's based on the work of Wilhelm Reich, and it's called Orgonomy. And that's a whole other story. So I do have a lot of stories.
Oh,
to
my
tell.
Gosh. Yes, you do. Now, that because I was thinking life four with your psychiatrist husband was kind of where you are now, but you, in between there, you've had the Peru experience and also a different kind of spiritual awakening separate from like Native American spirituality. So what did you learn from those things?
I think over the last 24 years that I've had Kyla, I've learned how important it is to be willing to put your child in front of you, ahead of you, and to not be selfish if you want to be a good parent. That doesn't mean to not be true to yourself, but it means that in everything you do, you have to be aware that there is this life that you have chosen to bring into the world and to guide, and that really, in I think, is probably the most important thing that I've done in my life, because she is a wonderful young woman.
And she's 21 now?
She's 23.
Oh, 23. Oh, my goodness.
And
wow.
She just finished a post-bac year in art. She's a fantastic artist. And she's on her way down to Disney to do a college internship there.
Oh, great.
And that's been her vision, which is funny because the first time I took her to Disney, I said, this is so different from everything I thought I believed in. I had to suspend again all my beliefs to become a child again and enjoy that. And I learned a tremendous amount from that. My life has been a lot of changing and suspending and reevaluating and being willing to learn new things, even if they aren't the same things that I've learned before.
You know, I think that's probably the most important thing that anyone can learn, and that's to be adaptable. To be able to adapt to other ways of thinking and doing, and not be rigid in that, well, this is the way it is, and this is the way I was taught, and this is the way Grandpa did it, or whatever, you know, to be adaptable and open to other viewpoints and other ways of living. And you've had an amazing and extraordinary journey through all these lifetimes. And so much of your work. I mean, you're a wonderful writer, a trained writer, and so much of your work, though, has been in co-authoring books with other people and their visions. And you know where I'm going with this, right?
Yes, I do. And the same place that Kyla, my daughter, keeps saying to me, "Mom, would you please write your adventures? That's what I want to read that you can write."
Well, that's you see, you have gained great wisdom and great understanding through all those adventures, and it's been cross-cultural. You've known many different ways of life and many different ways of being spiritual and many different ways for a woman to be fulfilled and successful and how to raise children in a good way so they grow up with self-esteem and enthusiasm for their future. So you have so much to share. Don't you think maybe it's time for you to write down some of this extraordinary experience that you've been through?
Yes, I absolutely do. And this has been a very hard interview for me because I'm not used to putting myself, and that sounds odd because if you read Woman of the Dawn, certainly I put myself out there. It's easier for me to do in writing than in talking. I've told you more than I've told many of my best friends.
Oh my goodness. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. Okay.
And
Well, you know, now I know you've got a new book coming out. It's probably out maybe in August or sometime toward the end of summer or fall. And this
right.
one is another leap into something different. You co-authored this with a medical doctor. And tell us a little bit about what the premise of this book is.
The book is called Regenerative Healing for Life: A New Paradigm to Treat Injuries and Pain Without Surgery. And this is one I learned about because I needed it. I have problems with arthritis and trauma-induced arthritis, another story that we won't go into. And this doctor has helped me keep my joints. And there are ways of healing problems with joints and with the musculoskeletal system, tendons and ligaments that are very effective, that are not based upon the normal, let's give them pain medicine to suppress the symptoms, or let's see if surgery will do it. And the book is about the proper way to care for injury. And almost everybody has an injury at some point or other in their life from the time of injury on. And you can avoid so much injury if you take care of things properly initially. And the book also goes into methods of taking care of things that have become chronic, like arthritis, and gone on for a long period of time. And Dr. Brian Scheipel, who is a DO, my husband is also a DO, is a man who is on the cutting edge of what I think will be new specialties in medicine called interventional orthopedics, similar to interventional cardiology, and integrative orthopedic medicine, which will be a specialty that will integrate what we know about orthopedics with more nutritional, hormonal solutions to some problems that people have. So it's a massive book. I learned a tremendous amount doing it. It's 400 pages.
Oh my goodness.
And it both makes the public aware of what's available to them and makes doctors aware that there's going to be a lot of people saying, "Hey, why aren't you doing this? It sounds a lot better than having a titanium joint if I don't have to do it."
Yes. Well, you know, so far, most of the treatment for arthritis, or rheumatism or any of that has been mainly pain medication to block the discomforts. You know, there hasn't been anything that to actually improve their condition or to help them avoid surgery, because surgery usually seems to just complicate matters and add to more problems, you know?
It certainly can. I've had the opportunity to experience both, and it can complicate matters. In fact, if you have an arthritic joint, and I tore the meniscus in my knee, and I had arthritis, and as Dr. Scheipel says, it's like sticking your hand in a beehive if you have arthritis, and you get surgery short of joint replacement, it stirs up the arthritis a lot. And that certainly was true of me, but luckily he has some methods that calm things down, and I still have two bone knees instead of knees made of something else.
Oh, good. Okay.
And I'm grateful
now,
for that.
You also mentioned something about alternative medicines. Does it also include some of the more alternative type treatments?
He is practicing sports medicine. He is not an alternative medicine physician. He's just very cutting edge in the field of medicine that he's involved with. There are other people, and some of them are covered in the book, who are doing more alternative things. But the book is geared to tell people what they are, but to emphasize this particular new field of medicine.
Okay, so it's some sort of injections into the joints, or?
Yeah, of dextrose and lidocaine, and of your own stem cells, not stem cells from somebody else, but
right,
and something called PRP, platelet-rich plasma, which is injection of, a lot of athletes do this, injection of your own blood platelets into the injured joint, which stimulates natural stem cell regrowth.
Okay. I misunderstood. I thought there was also some emphasis on alternative therapies as well as orthodox medical treatments.
Well, this is hopefully it will be orthodox medical treatment. It's very cutting edge medical treatment at this point.
Okay.
The book also goes into things like biopuncture, which uses homeopathy in addition to these methods, and mentions hormonal, natural hormone replacement therapies, which are wonderful adjuncts for anybody who's been in chronic pain.
Okay. We are out of time, Wobbin. So tell us again the name of the book so that people can watch for it.
Okay. And they can check my website, MarliceWobbinWin.com, and get information about it there. But the website for the book will be called Regen, R-E-G-E-N, the number for life.
Okay.
And I thank you so much for giving me the message you've given me.
okay. Well, I'm looking forward to reading your book one of these days, sometime soon, hopefully, about this extraordinary life you've lived and all the wisdom you've gained and the lessons you've learned all the way through these things. You have so much to share. I can't wait.
Well, thank you. And you do, too. And it's always such a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Wobbin. Have a wonderful day. And we'll have you on again sometime in the future. Okay. And for my listeners, be sure and tune in again next week for more exciting looks at healing methods. And until then, may the sun kiss your face, may the waters bless your body, and may all nature sing in your presence.